Welcome to the Watson Life Sciences podcast. My name is Ron Linder. I work at SDI, that's Scottish Development International. That's the International Trade Investment Agency of Scotland. I'm based here in Bern, Switzerland, and this podcast is all about the life science industry, usually from Scottish companies to the Swiss biotech and pharmaceutical market. The topic of today's podcast is what is human tissue research? And to understand what that is, we really have to look into how drugs are tested effectively and develop it, really. What you really have, that once you leave the lab stage, once you are testing in animals, you have a certain issue and a certain challenge, basically. That is that the diseases that you have in animals don't one-on-one correspond to how they are in human beings. Be it for cancer, for example, or diabetes, they're very, very similar, or can be very similar, but there's always differences in how human beings work effectively and also individually within humanity. We have different genes or genomes. It can vary significantly how drugs work within human beings. So what human tissue research is actually looking at is looking at donated bits of tissue. So it can be some skin, it can be some disease tissue like cancers and cancer biopsies, it can be blood, it can be various other things, where we basically look at that often after animal studies and check possible side effects we'll have before we go into the clinic, before we test an actual human being. So let me introduce the guest of our today's podcast, What is Human Tissue Research? And my guest is David Bunton. David, hello.
Thank you, Roland. Delighted to be here.
Pleasure to have you. David, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself? Just a quick intro.
Sure. I'm the CEO at Repricel Europe, based in Glasgow in the UK. My background is pharmacology, physiology. I was a lecturer in physiology at Glasgow Caledonian University and then spun out a life science company called Biopta back in 2002, which was acquired by Repricel, Japanese company, in 2015. And I'm still with Repricel and now head up their European operations.
So do tell us a little bit, what actually exactly does Repricel do?
So Repricel is a life science company that provides products and services, primarily in regenerative medicine and drug discovery focused around human data, human tissue systems, and human engineered tissue models. Mm-hmm. Repricel was one of the first companies to commercialize a particular type of stem cells called induced pluripotent stem cells, which are those that are taken from adult tissue and reprogrammed back into stem cells. And it's been very successful Japanese company in that field, and then acquired a number of complementary businesses in the past 5 or 6 years around stem cell and human tissue research space, but all really linked by a common theme of human data and human relevant test systems.
And in the spirit of this podcast, you guys are all based in Scotland, but the company itself, Repricel, is a Japanese company originally, if I got this right.
That's right, yeah. So our group headquarters are in Yokohama in Japan. We are in the UK and in Glasgow and also in Durham. We have our products distribution there. But Repricel also has labs in Maryland and US and also in Hyderabad in India.
Truly global then?
Truly global, yeah.
So David, do tell us then, what is human tissue research?
So human tissue research is quite a broad area covering the use of human biospecimens that have been appropriately donated and consented for research by patients. It covers medical research, in some cases chemicals or agrochemical research or medical devices. But its most common use is in drug discovery and development, either in academia or in industry, to try and really base our decisions about the safety and efficacy of drugs for human use, using human systems. So it's really become very common area in the past 10 to 15 years, in particular with the advent of precision medicine and the Human Genome Project.
Now do tell me, where exactly do tissues actually come from?
So tissues are, this really key to the whole process is the logistics and the appropriate processes for collecting biospecimens. These are extremely precious samples that are donated by patients And the starting point for that is really the informed consent of the patients and the donors of the tissue. They come from a number of routes, but the three primary routes, one of which is surgical residual material. So if there's a surgical process that may generate some additional material for research, of course, the care of the patient really comes first. So any tissue that's required for diagnostics is most important. But if there's other tissue available at that point, usually the pathologist will decide that it may be donated to research. Okay. Second route is transplant tissue, which again, transplantation is the primary objective with transplant organs. But those same networks allow access to organs that for whatever reason, there's a number of reasons organs may not be placed for transplant, then they could be used for research. And a third route is biopsy material, where patients or volunteers donate samples. And most of us will be familiar with the idea of a blood sample, but it may also be skin biopsy or muscle biopsy. Or we've all, again, over the past year and a half, become familiar with the use of nasal swabs and so on to collect some biological sample for COVID testing.
Understood. So, for example, let's imagine during an operation, they remove some cancerous tissue. For example, as a patient, I'm happy with that to be shared for medical research, for example. Then, for example, that will be one of the sources, right?
Exactly. That's a very common source where tissue is being resected anyway. And of course, with the consent of the patient, it may be used for other purposes. And it's very important that the patient is informed. Usually there's a patient information booklet or some other material that explains the uses and the journey that the tissue will go on, and also whether it's for commercial or non-commercial research.
Tell me a little bit about the journey here. Once you donate some of your tissue at a hospital, for example, where does the tissue travel afterwards? What's the logistical aspect about it? Where does it go?
Typically for tissue from surgery, it will firstly go to pathology and through the hands of the team that is diagnosing the treatment options for the patient. At that point, the pathologist will decide whether or not there's any tissue that could be made available for research. And if so, that will be preserved or stored in an appropriate way. Again, depending on the purpose of the research. So if it's a static study where we don't need to look at function, we're just looking at structure, then the tissue could be frozen or fixed in that point of time, typically formaldehyde or perhaps in some other solution or frozen at that stage. For many of the studies that we do, we are very interested in using the tissue fresh as a model of living tissue. And so we're really keen to retain the function and the physiological relevance to the behavior of the tissue in the body. So we essentially do as little as possible to the tissue and maintain it in a physiological buffer or culture media, depending on the type of tissue, and then transport that to the laboratory as fast as possible so that functionality is well maintained.
How does it actually exactly look like if you have those tissues, right, and they're still alive or, you know, living in that sense? How long do they actually survive in the lab and, you know, doing the transport as well?
It really varies according to the tissue type. And here it's quite similar to the rules that apply to a transplant network or, you know, what we may be familiar with different types of tissues that have various metabolic rates and different sensitivities to being out of the body and in a solution. So tissue like heart, for example, is very active. It doesn't survive more than a few hours, whereas other tissues such as skin may be somewhat less metabolically active, can be transported and preserved a little easier. But typically, we're talking about a matter of minutes to hours to get it to the lab and get it into a test system. So it really becomes a 24/7 lab operation to support these types of studies.
I was going to say, you really have to get your logistics and the processing afterwards really onto to quite a high speed in that sense, right?
In many respects, the companies that have grown in the past 10, 15 years are experts in logistics. And so it's not just the science or the laboratory experiments, but it's also those processes to collect, store, transport the tissue and maintain it in good condition. It's really key that as a starting point that you know the material you have is as close to the starting point in the body. You want it to represent that normal physiology or pathophysiology. So typically most of our experiments, we will also qualify the tissues at the start of experiments to determine whether it's in good enough condition at that point to undergo the experimental protocol. It's like a mini clinical trial in a sense, but rather than actually, you know, the patient taking the drug at that stage, it's we've heard it often called phase zero or other terms. It's late stage preclinical, and it's offering that translation between the preclinical test and the clinic, because you're, if done right, you're maintaining a tissue with its 3D architecture intact and the different complex mixture of cells that retains much of the functionality, not all of it. I mean, there are limitations. It's no longer perfused through the cardiovascular system. It retains many of the features, and it's just about as close a model as you can get in vivo setting, but doing it instead in a lab, an in vitro ex vivo setting.
So if the speed of how quickly you can get it, start doing the work on it, if that's one of the key aspects, and I guess also it's always key that you make sure that all the patients are willing to donate the tissues in the first place, right? I think that's good. How willing are people to donate tissues?
I mean, patients are extremely supportive of this type of research, whether it's in the commercial or non-commercial sphere. And there's a number of surveys and publications have looked at this area and have determined that over 95% of patients support this type of research. So it's critical that we continue to get the support of the public and show the benefits of it, show the way in which medicines can be brought to market quicker to patient benefit, and you can demonstrate safety and efficacy more clearly in patients. And, you know, we may come back to it later, but I think that precision medicine is one of the ways in which the public is becoming more aware of that need to understand not only the responses in humans, but how we individually, how we respond to different drugs.
So let's maybe look at how it's used in research, right? I understand the idea that, you know, the skin has, for example, human skin that's donated, obviously it's closer to what you ultimately want to test on a human being effectively. You want to kind of see how it would affect human being instead of actually being exposed to human being. But in what setting is it mainly used? And what's the goal of human tissues? Where is it mainly used in research?
Yeah, as you say, it can be used in many areas. I think the most common use of the functional tissues, the fresh tissues that we use, is in late stage preclinical or around lead optimization, where there's a small number of promising drug candidates. And really the objective is to try and understand, does the early evidence for engagement of the drug target and perhaps evidence from cell-based models or animal models, does that translate to humans? Do we actually see those signaling pathways activated? Do we see some readouts of biomarkers from the tissue that would indicate efficacy or perhaps be useful in showing that there are few side effects? So it tends to be used around in preclinical, a late stage. But we also see many instances where, unfortunately, we are asked to investigate clinical problems, troubleshooting, if you like, of clinical observations, where perhaps the drug has not been through sufficient testing in human systems and unexpected safety effects occurred in the clinic. And that can be either the regulators or the sponsors of the research who will come back to us and say, can you help to explain this mechanism? We perhaps looked at the responses in the cardiovascular system of various animal models, but we didn't see any signal. But now we're seeing adverse effects in patients and volunteers. And that's where using the human fresh tissue again can give mechanistic insights into those effects that may differ between humans and animals.
So really what you're doing is effectively just as a last stop before you start a clinical trial. So basically before you have human volunteers for the medications, right? That's literally where you want to make sure that this is basically the lab data that you have, the animal testing data that you have, that it actually does what it's meant to be doing, right? As a last safety check, almost last conviction check in a sense.
That's the most common application it's not something that's done in very high throughput, because we're taking samples from patients and we're We're not looking at, you know, a high throughput cell-based model. We've got complex intact tissues. So it's relatively low throughput. But for pharmacology, we can achieve reasonably good throughput for this type of test. You know, you could be looking at 20 to 30 individual tissues from one original tissue from a single donor. So you can still look at multiple compounds, but you're absolutely right. It tends to be fairly late stage, either lead optimization into preclinical safety or, like, you know, late stage preclinical in general.
And when you talk about the industries that are using it mainly, I guess it's mainly biotech industry and the pharmaceutical industry that are really mainly applying human tissue research per se.
That's right. It's but, you know, the overwhelming use of it is in pharma and biotech. But we've done a number of studies in say agrochemical or medical device area, where, you know, again, there may be no suitable model in cells or animals that are that really reflect what we're trying to assess. So, for example, assessing risk of a particular chemical or pesticide on reproductive health, or perhaps recreating the physical characteristics of a blood vessel in the lab, which you know, may be important for certain medical devices such as stents. So there are a number of uses, but the overwhelming one is in drug discovery, and that's both for small molecule, traditional small molecules, and also for biologicals.
What would you say then is the main need that human tissue research addresses?
I think the main need is that, you know, it's recognized, despite all our advances and improvements in science, there is still a problem with translation from preclinical to clinical, in particular prediction of efficacy. And that is probably, you know, over the past 20 years, I would say 50, 60% of our studies have been some demonstration of efficacy or a proof of concept, if you like, in the human disease tissue from the target patient population, that this drug candidate and the, you know, it's also about validating further the drug target, that actually has a likely benefit to patients. So that, you know, that's really used properly, it should reduce greatly clinical attrition rates. And that's where, you know, we estimate we've saved clients huge sums at these later stages from the many hundreds of drug candidates that have gone through our lab. And I would say is the biggest, you know, it's really the biggest need is that serious problem that still exists of clinical attrition.
You want to prevent the kind of issue where, let's say, you're in a phase two clinical trial and you realize, okay, hang on, this isn't actually working as intended. All our previous lab data that we have, all our animal data was things and completely else. And here we are, it's not actually working as we thought it would.
That's right. That's right. And that's still all too common. And, you know, unfortunately, depending on the therapeutic area, it can be, you know, it can be one in 10 of compounds that fail, or even, you know, as many as one in five. So it's very difficult. We'll succeed to, you know, we're seeing 90% failure rates to 95% failure rates in some areas. So it's something that, you know, everyone knows that it's a problem, but you know, no one would say that human tissue on its own is going to address all those issues. It's far too complex a problem. There's too many factors involved in that translation. But certainly there is a focus generally, not just through fresh tissues, but also through that use of fixed or frozen tissues, stem cell models, more complex 3D tissue models and organ-in-a-chip technologies more recently. These are all part of a solution which is helping to improve our understanding of the complex human biology.
I hear you. You're basically saying, look, we have another data point that's actually quite important. Hopefully it will lead us to the right conclusions, right?
That's right.
We can't guarantee that, of course, because let's be honest, human bodies can be a little bit more complex than we sometimes think. Sadly.
Exactly. It's reducing risk at each stage. You know, there can be no guarantee of success. But it's reducing risk at every step.
Where would you think does it make most sense to use human tissues? What kind of therapeutic goals are you looking at mainly? What do you generally look into treat? So what would you say is the most common therapeutic areas that are targeted or investigated using human tissues?
Much of this research originated in cancer, as you mentioned earlier about sourcing of tissues, but also the research itself originated in the use of tumors to characterize the differences between tumor types, and in particular to look at, you know, molecular biology. That really was the foundation for a lot of the tissue networks that allowed access to the samples. But and it remains a key area for research and drug discovery, and is of course a huge area in the pharmaceutical industry. But now it's, you know, covers many different types of therapies, from cardiovascular, which is where we started out, was looking at in particular heart failure, hypertension, and so on, to respiratory, respiratory diseases, asthma, COPD. And over the past 10 years, probably the most rapidly growing field has been in autoimmune disorders, things like psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, and inflammatory bowel diseases, which, you know, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis are on the increase. And there's a lot of focus in pharma on therapies, in particular biologicals, to try and have earlier intervention and prevent that disease progression in patients. So really the key is to get the relevant tissue type for the therapeutic area. So for example, for Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, is to get the actual inflamed region of the bowel fresh and use that as a model of drug effectiveness. And that's, I think, one of the powers of the human tissue approach.
So if we're talking about one of the powers in that sense, then can you maybe tell us how it compares, how this type of research compares in terms of like the benefits, the efforts, the costs to other types of research?
Yeah, this is, you know, there are strengths and weaknesses to every approach, and human tissue is no different. When we started out the company in the early 2000s, there were many companies who really embraced this approach and others who were more reluctant to, because it was quite different from traditional cell-based or animal approaches, which tend to focus on reproducibility and robustness of the assay more than the translation to humans. Whereas the human tissue, it is more variable. You know, there is no getting away from the fact that the responses in human tissues from, say, 10 or 20 donors will be more variable than a comparable study in, you know, 20 rats where they're all inbred or outbred and pretty similar in their responses. It used to be that was seen as a weakness of human tissues, but increasingly that's now understood as being one of the strengths, because that variation in response is what happens in the clinical trials and is now understood as a key reason why sometimes very promising drugs fail. That they may well be benefiting a section of the target patient population in the clinical study, but other patients see little or no response. So trying to understand that variation and the reasons for that variation between individuals by looking at genetics, by looking at clinical history, medical history, these are all key factors now in understanding a variation in drug response early in drug discovery. This allows potential to design clinical trials differently, or to at least have more confidence that the target patient population is the right one. And I think that's one of the key benefits. And it's really, of course, as you say, a cost-benefit analysis as to how early that is done in the drug discovery process. And I think in general, human data and human test systems have tended to move earlier in discovery. Really having a fail fast, fail early approach has been shown to have huge cost savings downstream, because costs increase the further that you go through the clinical trials. So having that increased understanding at preclinical stage, even if it means more compounds are either discontinued or perhaps the target patient population is smaller than originally planned, that's still pays dividends when it comes to higher success in the clinic.
That's a very interesting notion, but it totally makes sense. In a lab setting, you always want to have almost like a standardized setting, so you're always testing against the same thing. Well, of course, in reality, it's nothing like that when you actually deal with somewhat diverse patient populations, right?
Yeah, it's very different. And that is, I think it's taken some time. And as I say, there's some resistance in our early days to, you know, that variation in response that we would, sometimes we may be doing studies in quite small numbers of donors just to look and see, is there any evidence of an effect in humans? And, you know, if you take 5 to 10 donors, you might see you know, two or three where there's super responders, if you call them that, two or three where there's a, you know, a reasonable response and perhaps a handful where there's no response. And I think that is now accepted much more readily because of precision medicine, because of the Human Genome Project, because there's, I think, a greater awareness in the public as well that we don't all respond in the same way to drugs. That, you know, that was perhaps a quite a difficult message to communicate 10, 15 years ago, where scientists would in drug discovery would know that, but I think wider public was maybe not appreciate that if they, you know, they try medicine A that it hasn't worked, and that's not because of, you know, that was the wrong medicine to prescribe at that time. It was just there was no understanding really of what the factors would be in that individual that might see that drug work or not. And that is gradually changing. That is, you know, underpinning precision medicine, personalized medicine, but we've still got a long way to go before that's truly implemented.
That's a fascinating notion that something may well, a therapy or a medication might really work well on one person and may not work on the other, in an extreme case, of course.
Yes.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. When we're talking about human tissue research, is that something that pharma and biotech companies would usually do in-house? Is it outsourced?
The tendency is usually to outsource, but there are many excellent labs in pharma, in academia, who will do this type of work. So it does require specialist knowledge. It requires the access to the tissue, the logistics, and the flexibility of the 24/7 lab operation I mentioned. So we tend to see that it's most commonly done in specialist contract research organizations, or there are specialist academic groups who may focus on a niche area of particular disease area or tissue type. Doing it in a commercial lab has a number of benefits in that, for example, you know, regulatory approval is possible for the safety assessments that can be done in human tissue. So having that a quality assurance system is certainly a benefit. And also having the flexibility as a contract research company that's doing these things day in, day out, it becomes then economical to actually run a lab 24/7, which, you know, even big pharma may find that impractical to do that. So I would say most commonly it's outsourced, and that is probably fits with a growing trend in pharma industry in general the past 10, 20 years of working with specialist partnerships and outsourcing, you know, the right type of work.
Right, because you rather have a partner that's super specialized on this so they can actually give you exactly what you want rather than you necessarily building it up yourself, basically.
Exactly, and I think there is a lot to develop and a lot to consider before embarking in one of these projects. You know, there's the ethical approval, there's the logistics of the supply chain that we discussed, there's the protocols and the validation around the different tissue types. So there's a lot of variables by the time you factor in the possible number of tissue types, different targets, different platforms that can be used. There's actually quite a number of approaches. So having groups that have got experience across a wide range of those things really helps.
So would you say then that demand for human tissue research has gone up in the last few years?
Yeah, I think it has been driven up by precision medicine, but also driven up again in the past 18 months by COVID. So there's been such a strong interest in collecting COVID positive and negative samples for research, both to you know, to look at the way in which patients have been responding to vaccines or different therapies, but also understanding that you know, the biology of disease, and again interest in some of these complex models, either fresh tissue or three-dimensional tissue models that would allow, for example, assessment of infection of a tissue such as a nasal mucosa tissue, or infection, you know, coronavirus can infect the gut as well. So looking at that interaction with different types of tissues. And I actually, one of the first studies that came out about SARS-CoV-2 was around its ability to infect so many different types of cells, which is quite an unusual characteristic and one of the, you know, potentially such dangerous aspects of the virus, and that came about through human tissue studies looking at that also gene expression of the targets, the angiotensin receptors and so on in the tissues. So there's been a real increase in the use of human tissue for research. It's been a trend that's been there the past 10 to 15 years anyway, but I can only see that increasing through those drivers of precision medicine and also artificial intelligence.
How do you think the regulators view the data you generate with human tissue research? What's the views on, say, shall we say, the FDA, MHRA, Swissmedic, for example, on this?
I think what's been interesting about this is that the regulators have very much gone through this process with industry, and in some cases have been at the forefront of efforts to remove barriers to research using human data. So, you know, they've certainly not presented unreasonable barriers to it. They've tried to promote the appropriate use of human test systems. Now, the types of tests we're talking about today in fresh tissue are not mandatory, but they are supportive studies for safety pharmacology. And on occasion, we've had requests from regulators for specific studies. I mentioned, for example, the troubleshooting of adverse effects in clinical trials. So we found, in particular, the FDA and the MHRA, they have really taken the initiative alongside organisations like the NC3Rs in the UK, which is a UK government-supported institute that looks at ways to refine, reduce, replace animal experiments, and actually have published in the very good publication in Nature Biotech around 5 years ago, which was a survey of the pharma industry and asking about the barriers to increased use of human tissue in safety assessment. And that tends to be a primary focus for the regulators has been in safety assessment. And that showed that most pharma companies were either using the technology or developing methods to use it. And that included human fresh tissue, but also other approaches such as the 3D models. So I think the regulators are very supportive. It's not a panacea. By no means does it hold the prospect, I think, in the short term of replacing all animal experiments. I think that's unrealistic, but it certainly is already reducing and refining those experiments. And there's going to be further progress for sure over the next 10 years.
So in summary, what you're saying, at this moment in time, the regular perspective is one of happy to take that additional data, especially if it tells us more. At the same time, it's not mandatory yet, but at some point, there is at least a chance to actually reduce the amount of animal testing we'd need to do at some point, right?
I think that's right. It's a case-by-case basis. And typically, if it's a target where it's understood something like serotonin receptors, for example, that animal models may not reflect human biology, then the regulators may request, you need to include some human tissue systems in here. Or it could be the sponsors in pharma themselves that identify, there are potential risks, there are known risks around this class of drug, that really we need human data. So I think it's being driven by what we said earlier about those causes of clinical failure, being efficacy, safety, and in some cases pharmacokinetic issues. Those three big areas, they will account for most of the clinical failures. And those are the areas where human tissue is being employed.
You mentioned beforehand also that AI is going to affect the field. So what does the future hold for human tissue research? What do you think is going to happen in the next few years?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting space because, of course, we've got more data than anyone could imagine. And, the challenge is not sometimes to generate the data. The challenge is to how to use that, to use those data intelligently to gain some insights. I think that the insights are not going to come from genomics or transcriptomics alone. Time and again, we've seen that the predictions that are made just from looking at, say, next gen sequencing, are not sufficient to understand the pharmacology. So to get to true pharmacogenomics, we need to include the functional data, the understanding of the omics, but also the other information about individuals, the clinical data, the medical history, the what drug history has that individual been exposed to, And that's really where artificial intelligence could help us make some breakthroughs, because again, we're increasing the volume of the data and the complexity. But I think we can achieve insights that wouldn't otherwise be possible by appropriate use of AI machine learning models.
I hear you. Because effectively, you can then access it from a big data perspective, get a different sources of data, and actually hopefully come up with coherent information that is actually useful and helps us drive science forward, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. I mean, we've done some preliminary work in this field and published some initial work with the Precision Medicine Innovation Centre here in Scotland, and also more recently working with experts in AI machine learning, and we have gained some insights into the potential reasons why an individual might respond to particular drugs in our fresh tissue system. So essentially using the human fresh tissue as a proxy for the likely clinical response of the individual. And that's because it's the closest we could get to the individual's response. So measuring that efficacy in the lab, and then understanding what are the clinical or genomic factors that have determined why those individuals have responded and perhaps other individuals have not. Mm. So I think that's a very exciting area, really bringing together pharmacogenomics.
Absolutely. It does sound very interesting. I imagine, though, that the quality of the data that you need to actually go as an input must be very high then. It must be accurate. It must be relevant, right? Otherwise.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's key. The quality of the data, and I think a challenge is the number of donors that are needed. But again, these are things which have a lot of effort been made internationally and within both public and private sector initiatives to have appropriate mechanisms to safely share data and gather data. So, for example, in Scotland, the network of what are called safe havens are NHS, they're National Health Service run institutions that can really provide a firewall between the patient data in the healthcare system and the appropriate use by pharmaceutical companies, CROs, or other academic researchers. And so they ensure appropriate anonymization and appropriate access, but still support that type of research, enable that type of research to ensure that we can make those medical breakthroughs.
One of the main benefits of having a centralized health service, you do have standardized data. There's no doubt about it.
That's definitely a benefit in the UK in general, and in Scotland in particular, Scotland-wide, there is this health identification number that every individual from cradle to grave has that number, which identifies all of the health records and allows access to, for example, all medical history, prescription history. And looking at these things is important, not just for medical research, but also for economics and so on. So there is a huge benefit to that. But of course, the other part of that is the trust and the transparency with which that's done with the public, to bring the public along as to the benefits of that research.
If any of our listeners would like to contact Repricel about human tissue research, how would they best go about that?
Sure, I'd be delighted to discuss any of the ideas or concepts in the discussion today. And the best way is through our website, repricel.com. We've got our contact details for all our sites and email addresses on there.
David, thank you so much for this. It's been absolutely delightful and insightful. I learned a lot more. Now, next time I go to hospital or I'm in a doctor's office and they take some tissue samples, I'll make sure that everything is signed and I can be done.
Thank you, Roland. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David.